Today is Monday, December 14th, 2009. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Rebecca Regnery, the Deputy Director for Humane Society International. I'll talk with her about the shark fin trade, the problem of shark finning, which is the practice of taking only a shark's fins because of their high value, and tossing the rest of the animal back into the sea, and her work to stop it. Sharks are often called silent hunters. Believe it or not, they have no organs with which to make sound. So, for this week's Creature Call, I'm featuring a different endangered sea creature that lives in both tropical and cool waters. This large marine mammal uses echolocation to catch its prey in the deep ocean, and it's been known to dive as deep as 10,500 feet. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's Creature Call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what they are, and also give you a preview of next week's Creature Call. Now, let me turn to my conversation on shark finning with Rebecca Regnery. Ms. Regnery is responsible for managing the wildlife programs of the Humane Society International, and also the organization's involvement in international treaties and agreements. She co-chairs the Species Survival Network Sea Turtle and Marine Fish Working Groups, and leads international efforts to develop policies to put an end to shark finning. We always think of sharks as a top predator, but there's one that's far worse, humans. Sharks kill an average of about 10 people each year, yet during that same time frame, people kill about 100 million sharks. A main reason for this imbalance? A desire for their fins, which are used to make shark fin soup. Shark fin soup is a culinary delicacy in many Asian cultures. While shark fins are flavorless, their cartilage provides a gelatinous, chewy consistency in soup. For years, this high-priced extravagance, which can run up to $100 per bowl, was reserved for the rich, and thus had little impact on overall shark populations. But that's changed. The more recent explosion of Asia's middle class has caused demand for the status symbol to swell, and that's bad for the sharks. Pound for pound, shark fins are the most valuable part of the shark. That, plus limited space on fishing vessels, now prompt many shark fishermen to simply cut off the fins and toss the rest of the animal back into the water where it can't survive. As we'll hear, in many places, shark finning is legal, and regulations that do exist are difficult to enforce. Only a few countries demand that sharks arrive in port with fins attached. But that might change. With humans driving several shark species to the brink of extinction, the tide is shifting and new legal protections have been proposed. In the United States, the Shark Conservation Act, which will close enforcement loopholes, is now before Congress. In the international arena, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, also known as CITES, will consider proposals to protect several additional shark species when it meets in March 2010. When I spoke with Ms. Regnery a few weeks ago, I asked her to describe the shark trade and the problem of shark finning.
Well, a main issue with sharks is shark finning, which is the practice of capturing a shark at sea, cutting the fins off the shark, and throwing the rest of the shark back overboard. Usually the shark is still alive, and the shark either bleeds to death or is eaten by other sharks or simply starves because it can't swim and it can't get food. It's a really cruel and wasteful practice, and it's all to supply the demand for Asian shark fin soup.
And what is shark fin soup good for?
It's actually a delicacy. I've never had it myself, but from what I understand, it's a chicken broth with shark fin in it, and the shark fin itself has no taste, but it's the texture that's popular. It's the cartilage, so it's chewy, And it's considered a status symbol in Asia. It used to be that only the very wealthy could afford it, but now almost anybody can. It's usually served at special occasions like weddings or celebrations, or really any time that a host wants to impress their guest.
How much does a bowl of shark fin soup cost? And where can you get it? Can I get it here in the US?
You can get it at almost any high-end Chinese restaurant around the world. And the price varies, but often there it's one big bowl that serves multiple people, and it can cost as much as about $500 for a bowl.
And how many people does that bowl serve?
I believe it could be about 10. Yeah,
Okay.
it's small bowls. It's just a little taste. It's not like a, it's not a meal. It's before the meal.
And is it served all across Asia, or you had said Chinese restaurant? Is it served in other
It's
Asian countries as well?
yeah, it's served in pretty much every country that has Chinese restaurants.
And what about the types of species used?
The most popular type is a is are fins that have very high cartilage count, so very high. They call it a needle count. I always want to say thread count. I always think sheets, but it's needle count. So a very sort of thick fin. And shark species that are used a lot for that include hammerhead sharks. Oceanic white tip sharks, blue sharks, and actually almost any shark. There's very few that cannot be used for shark fin soup. It's just a matter of the quality and the cost. If it has a higher needle count, it's more expensive.
And how, what is a needle count? How do you?
It's the strands of cartilage. Like cartilage in your ear or hair, it's the more cartilage in the fin, the more valuable it is.
Tell me more about why, about the biology of sharks, how they live, where do they live, how we can find them.
Sharks are one of the apex predators in the ocean. They're one of the largest fish. So they're very long-lived and slow to mature, and they don't have a lot of babies, which makes them very vulnerable to overfishing, overexploitation for fins or meat. They mostly live in deeper waters, but they can be found almost anywhere in the ocean. And they're very important to the ecosystem because they are apex predators. They balance the marine food web, so removing them can disrupt the entire ecosystem.
So, what do you mean by apex predators? Are they sort of like the wolf in
Yes.
Yellowstone?
Or they're often compared to lions, because they eat almost anything that's in the ocean. Actually, humans are one of their least favorite foods. In spite of the shark bites, it's usually them thinking that a human is a seal or a fish and taking a bite and then realizing, ooh, yuck, that's not what I wanted. But they eat almost all other fish. Some of them eat other sharks. So whereas smaller fish can only eat fish that are smaller than them, but sharks are one of the biggest fish in the ocean. So they eat sea turtles, seals, other fish, just about anything.
And do different species have different favorite foods, or do they, will they all eat turtles and all eat seals and
I think it depends on where they're located in the food supply. I don't know of different species having different favorite foods. I don't think they're picky eaters.
and you said they were long-lived. How long does a shark live?
varies by species, and I don't know that offhand. I think some species can live about 50 years, but I'd have to look that up. I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem.
I'm not a biologist, so I know more about the legislation than about the animals themselves.
We'll get to
Okay.
that. And you said they were slow to mature. So when do they start having babies?
They're actually similar to humans. They usually don't have babies until they're in their teenage years. Well, when humans can have babies, not when
Right.
humans usually have babies.
And how many babies do they have at a time?
Again, it varies, but some only have one or two. They're called pups. Some have up to 10. It varies by species.
And what species are most threatened by shark finning now?
The hammerheads are very threatened by shark finning. Oceanic white tips, poor beagle sharks, basking sharks, whale sharks not so much. Their fins are actually too big.
Oh, really?
Whale sharks, if their fins are used, it's usually for display at a store that sells shark fins wholesale. Blue sharks also are often used for fins. Most sharks' fins are used. Like I said, it's more a question of how valuable the fins are, and it's also a question of how valuable the shark meat is and whether or not it's consumed by humans. Even if a shark is very popular for its fins, if its meat is popular as well, it's not as likely to be finned, meaning have its fins caught off and thrown back overboard. And one of the problems with finning is if you do that, you can kill a lot more sharks because you can fit a lot more fins on the vessel. Whereas if you're taking the whole shark, you fill up your cargo hold pretty quickly. So if you're finning, if you're cutting the fins off and throwing the shark back overboard, you can kill a lot more sharks in one trip.
And so, how many sharks, I guess just by means of comparison, for a typical vessel, how many sharks are we talking about in one trip, for if you're taking a shark for meat versus if you're taking it just for its fins?
That really varies. It depends on the size of the vessel. And I'm not sure that we know that because if you're just taking the fins are all mixed together. A shark can have multiple fins. They have the dorsal fin on the back, the pectoral fins on the side, and they have their tails are fins, and then some sharks have one or two other little fins. So you can't really tell from looking at the fins how many sharks have been actually killed. And a lot of countries allow you to cut the fins off the shark and have the body of the shark and the fins on the boat separated, which makes it even harder to tell how many sharks are really there. What happens often is they will take sharks of higher value, meat-wise, and then fin sharks where the fins are more valuable than the meat and say that the sharks go together. It's sort of common to use a ratio system. It's very complicated, but the shark fins are supposed to weigh no more than 5% of the dressed weight of the carcasses. That's sort of a standard system to make sure that sharks have not been finned. However, it's very difficult to enforce, as you can imagine, and there's that problem of taking different shark bodies with fins from other species.
Yeah, we'll get back to that in a minute, but
Sure.
I'd love to talk about how They're regulated. You just were starting to talk about shark mm-hmm. fins are supposed to weigh no more than 5% of the weight mm-hmm. of the carcasses. And I'd love to find out, I guess first, is it legal to fish for sharks, say for meat? Because you see that a lot in restaurant shark.
Yeah, it's legal in almost every country. There are a handful of countries where it's not legal to fish for sharks at all. Palau is one of the countries. Israel is another. There's a few others.
And so then what, how are they regulated? How is the fishing for sharks regulated?
It varies by country, but usually there's a quota. You're allowed to take X number of sharks. And usually it doesn't go down to the species level. It's really X number of sharks or X number of pelagic sharks or X number of reef sharks. So they haven't been collecting really good data on how many of each species of shark is being killed. And it's even more difficult to tell if the shark isn't brought to land whole. If you're just looking at a fin, or even if you're looking at a shark without its fins, many species look so similar that it's difficult to tell what species it is, even for experts.
And what are, you mentioned pelagic and reef sharks. Could mm-hmm. you describe what's the difference between them and how many other kinds of sharks are there? Big sharks are there.
Those are the main two. The pelagic are the ones that tend to live in deep water, and reef sharks live around coral reefs. But some, we believe, go back and forth. It depends on what they're doing, feeding, breeding. We actually don't know a lot about sharks and where they live and where they breed, and We just haven't been able to study them that thoroughly. And even species like whales that have been studied for a lot longer, we don't know everything about them either. It's just too hard to study species that are highly migratory that live in the ocean.
So sharks migrate?
Mm-hmm.
From where to where, I guess? Say taking U.S.-based sharks.
Yeah, usually they might migrate up and down the coast of the U.S. They might go down to the Caribbean, even South America. Depends on the species of sharks, and there are different populations within species that might live in certain areas and not migrate as far as others. That's another thing that we really don't know all the details. They're doing shark tagging studies where they'll tag a few sharks and try to figure out where they go and when, and try to figure out what they're doing. If they go to a certain area where to breed or to give birth or to feed, but there just isn't a lot of data on that yet.
And then how you said they're used for their fins and also meat. Are there any other products? Often see like necklaces with teeth and things like that.
Yeah, shark teeth are used for curios, and skin is sometimes used for different purposes. Cartilage is sometimes used, especially for medicinal purposes. Liver oil is used, but all of those are mainly byproducts. That's really when the shark is being caught for another purpose, and they're just trying to use more of the shark. Usually sharks aren't killed specifically for those purposes.
And where does most shark finning take place?
In the open oceans. It's a lot of Asian vessels from China, Taiwan, actually a lot of vessels from Spain as well. It's the larger vessels that can go out into the open ocean where there's less regulation, because shark finning is becoming illegal in more and more countries.
So what are the rules against shark finning?
In lots of countries, there are still no rules. In most of the countries that have rules, they use that 5% ratio. When a shark is brought to land, the fins on board the vessel should weigh no more than 5% of the weight of the rest of the shark. Now, sometimes it's the weight of the dress shark, which means the shark has been gutted and the tail has been cut off, the head's been cut off. Sometimes it's the whole shark. So the shark has only had its fins cut off. Both of them still allow finning. Both of them still allow some wiggle room for people to cut off the fins of some sharks and throw them back over, and you can still meet that 5% ratio. With the if it doesn't specify that it should be the dressed gutted weight, then it allows even more finning. The only way to ensure that a shark has not been thinned is to require that the shark is brought to land with its fins still naturally attached to the body.
And so, are these all domestic regulations for each country, or is there an international agreement? I understand the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization has an international plan of action for sharks, which recommended the full utilization of sharks. Is
That's right.
that law, or is that's a recommendation? Have countries.
That's a recommendation. The United Nations General Assembly also has a recommendation that sharks are fully utilized and urges countries to adopt regulations that fins must be attached. But there are the regional management fishing organizations which manage areas, fishing areas, usually for tuna. There are a bunch of them, but the biggest ones are for tuna fishing. And they, most of them use the 5% ratio, and that is an international regulation that's enforceable and not just a suggestion.
So what are these regional fishing
Fishing.
management organizations? How do they
They
work?
were started to make sure that countries work together to protect fish resources, to make sure that if one country sets a quota and a neighboring country is taking as many fish as they want, the quota is not going to have any effect. So all the countries that are members of an organization meet usually annually to decide on quotas. They also pass regulations on bycatch, which is accidental catch of species, and how to limit that, usually for sea turtles and seabirds, marine mammals, and more recently also sharks. Each organization has its own rules of procedure. Many of them are done by consensus. So all the member countries will sit around a table and discuss scientific recommendations for a quota or for a regulation to manage bycatch or a regulation to prohibit shark finning, and they'll agree by consensus.
And does the United States belong to one?
Yes, we belong to almost all of them, all of the ones where in regions where we fish.
So they're based by geographic region, so Pacific or Southern Pacific or something like that. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm most familiar with the tuna RFMOs. There's one that's for the Eastern Tropical Pacific. There's one for the Western Pacific. There's one for the Indian Ocean. There's one for the Atlantic. And there's one for, what is CCSBT? It covers southern bluefin tuna.
So, and they set quotas not just on sharks, but all
Actually, most of
fishes.
them don't set quotas on sharks. It's for the target species, so it's mostly tuna, sometimes swordfish. The only one that has so far set quotas on sharks is the Atlantic, the Commission for the Atlantic. So far, when they address sharks, it's saying that sharks should be released if they're caught accidentally and they should not be finned. If a shark is caught, it should either be released or it should be landed without cutting off its fins and throwing the shark back overboard. The whole shark should be brought to land.
And then how, so as far as sharks go, are there quotas on any particular species? Are any of the species protected?
That varies from country to country. And again, it's usually not, sometimes it's species, but it's usually broad categories of sharks. The concern about shark population depletion is relatively recent. We've been worrying about tuna, for example, for many years now. The Regional Fishery Management Organization I'm most familiar with, the IATTC, which is for the Eastern Tropical Pacific, was formed in the 1940s. But they haven't really addressed sharks until the past 5 or 6 years.
And was there something that precipitated concern about sharks?
It was research that showed that shark populations were being depleted. It was also once the target species starts to decline, the fishing effort moves to other species. So once there's less tuna to catch, they're more likely to catch sharks.
And in the US, I understand there's legislative effort currently. Could you talk about US legislation and what the process
Sure.
involves in that?
The U.S. in t first addressed shark the problem of shark thinning in 2000. We passed a bill that prohibited shark thinning and used that 5% ratio that I mentioned. It's then very difficult to enforce, very complicated. So recently, NOAA, which is part of the Department of Commerce, NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service, adopted regulations for the Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico, requiring that sharks be landed with their fins naturally attached, which is a complete ban on finning. But we haven't passed similar regulations in the Pacific. So because of that and other loopholes in the original bill, in the 2000 bill, there's legislation pending now that would require all sharks in the United States to be brought to land with their fins naturally attached. This legislation, which is called the Shark Conservation Act of 2009, has passed the House of Representatives twice. Last year it passed unanimously, but the Senate didn't have time to take action on it. It passed again earlier this year unanimously. And now it's pending in the Senate. On November 19th, the Senate Commerce Committee is going to consider the legislation and hopefully move it forward to the full Senate.
And then what happens from there if it goes through the Senate?
If the Senate also passes the legislation, then the president signs it. Then it will be in effect for the United States. All sharks will have to be brought to the land with their fins naturally attached, which would be a complete ban on shark finning in the United States.
And how come the Pacific wasn't originally included in those regulations in 2000? Was there a reason for that?
Actually, I believe it's because in the Pacific they catch a lot more sharks, so it would affect a lot more fishermen. So it takes more time to study what the effects would be and to consult with the fishermen and start the process.
And so, currently, is there any opposition to the Shark Conservation Act now from fishing groups or
Some of the fishing industry is worried that It will slow them down. It's much faster. If you're gonna catch a shark and you're gonna keep the meat anyway, it's faster to start processing the shark at sea instead of waiting until you get to land, especially if you're not familiar with the process. But the countries that have passed legislation requiring that all sharks are landed with their fins attached have perfected the process. One thing they do is they partially cut the shark's fin off so that the fins can be folded over. If you have a shark without its fins cut off at all, it's kind of like an airplane, you know, that the fins are all sticking out and you can't stack them and you can't freeze them very well. It's harder to gut the shark and store them properly. So that's that they've come up with a process where they gut the shark, they partially cut its fins off, they fold the fins over and tie them, and with that it doesn't take much extra time at all. It's very efficient. And the fishermen in the countries that have been doing this for some time now have no problem with it.
And where is that? What countries have already passed that kind of law?
Costa Rica, El Salvador, Colombia, Brazil, Panama, and recently the United Kingdom. And then there are a few countries like Palau that I mentioned where shark fishing is banned completely.
I understand. So in those countries, they have domestic legislation that requires
That
the
sharks are
shark to be
landed, yeah,
landed with a.
fins attached.
And how have those countries been at a disadvantage in the fishing industry? Are they pushing for this kind of legislation at
They
all?
have not been at a disadvantage. They're now starting to encourage this legislation in international bodies such as regional fishery management organizations because they're concerned about the shark populations plummeting. Most of those countries consume shark meat. They're concerned that with thinning being so widespread, shark populations are being wiped out very rapidly, which is depleting a very important source of protein for their countries.
And so I understand that there's new proposals within the CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Could you talk a little bit about the CITES agreement and how that works and what's being proposed?
Sure. CITES, as you said, is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. It has about 100 and, it's up to 175 member countries now, and it regulates international trade in wildlife. Right now, three shark species are covered by CITES: whale sharks, basking sharks, and white sharks. The next meeting of the Conference of the Parties to CITES, which is the big meeting of the CITES member countries where they make decisions, is next March 2010. There have been proposals to add four additional species of sharks to CITES: hammerhead sharks, oceanic white-tip sharks, poor beagle sharks, and spiny dogfish sharks. And the way CITES works, it has different appendices. An Appendix 1 listing means no international trade. An Appendix 2 listing means that international trade should be regulated and monitored to ensure that it's not having a negative effect on the species. All the shark proposals that have been adopted and have been proposed are for Appendix 2 listings. So we're not talking about a complete ban on international trade in these species, but rather monitoring and regulating them to make sure that the populations are not being depleted.
And who's supporting those proposals?
The two of them, the hammerhead and the oceanic white tip, were proposed by the United States and Palau. And the other two, the poor beagle and the spiny dogfish, were proposed by the European Union and Palau. Palau is on all four of them.
And are those the species most often found, say, in the U.S., is the hammerhead and oceanic white tip?
Not most often found as much as most affected negatively by international trade. Those two species are very prevalent in the fin trade, and their meat isn't used as much as their fins are, so they're very vulnerable to finning.
And the poor beagle and spiny dogfish, is it the same for them?
Actually, the poor beagle is used for fins and meat and has been overexploited for both. Spiny dogfish is actually mostly used for meat. It's the species that's most often used now in fish and chips.
Oh, really?
In the UK, yeah. And they've just been fished out. One of the problems with spiny dogfish is it's easier to catch pregnant females, which wipes out populations pretty quickly.
And why are they easier to catch?
I think because they come closer to shore. They're bigger, so you get more meat out of them. And I don't know for sure, but I'd guess they may be slower. I know human pregnant females are a little slower.
And so so if there is agreement to list them in Appendix 2, what would happen? You had said that they'd be monitored and regulated.
Mm-hmm. They'd have to, when they're trading the meat or the fins internationally from one country to another, they'd have to have a certificate showing that they were caught without damaging the population. It's called a non-detriment finding, that the trade of this species is not threatening the population.
And so is that done with quotas? There are so many permits issued, or?
It's really, each country has implementing legislation for CITES. So each country has their own method for determining that the population is not being depleted in their country or in their waters. Each country has a scientific authority. So with fish, it usually would be a quota. It'd be population studies and a quota and showing that the fish was caught legally, that it wasn't caught. There's a lot of unreported and illegal fishing. And once the fish comes to land, you know, you don't know how or where it was caught or by who. So it was showing that there was port control, that when the fish was brought to land, they knew who had caught it and that they had all their proper permits and were following the quotas.
What are some of the illegal fishing methods? How does someone poach fish?
It's not really the methods as much as not being registered properly, fishing in areas that are closed, fishing after the quota has been met, or fishing on a species where fishing has been prohibited, either for a time of the year or completely prohibited. For example, sandbar sharks have been depleted to the point where there is no fishing of sharks at all allowed off the Atlantic coast of the United States, other than for research purposes.
And have you seen violations of that? Has the U.S. seen violations of?
Yeah, I've heard about it. I haven't actually been to ports myself, but there are always violations. It's very hard to monitor. And speaking of poor beagles, sandbars and poor beagles, and not poor beagles, I'm sorry. Speaking of spiny dogfish, sandbar sharks and spiny dogfish sharks look a lot alike, especially if their fins are cut off. So someone could cut off the fins and bring a shark to land and say, this is a spiny dogfish. It's legal to catch spiny dogfish, where it's really a sandbar shark, and it was an illegal catch.
So how are they monitored? What agency in the U.S. is responsible for monitoring fishing there?
NOAA has its own enforcement agency, and the states also have their own enforcement officers.
And how can they tell what kind of shark it
If
is?
the fins are attached, it's much easier to tell. They have guides, and fishermen and enforcement agents have a pretty good idea, from the guides, what type of shark it is. When fins are cut off, and especially, of course, if you're just looking at a fin, it's much harder to tell.
Has anybody started looking at fins to try and distinguish between
Yes,
fins?
Japan actually has developed a guide for fins. I'm not sure how widespread it is yet, if it's being used. Right now, because of the ratio system, you don't really need to know what type of shark it is. But if fins attached will require that they identify the shark, which will make it much more important. There's a woman named Shelley Clark who has done a lot of research on the Hong Kong fin trade, which is the largest fin trade. And she's shown through her investigative research that the fin traders are actually very good at identifying the species. They don't use the proper names. They don't say this is a blue shark fin. They have their own names for them, but their accuracy is pretty good.
So the traders themselves can identify species from the fins, from only the fins, is that
They
right?
can. They can because it's their livelihood, so they know which fins are more valuable.
Now, is Japan a big shark fishing country that they've developed this guide for fins?
They're concerned about shark fishing. I don't think they catch more sharks than any of the other big industrialized nations, including us. But they are concerned about the depletion of sharks.
How have countries worked together on shark finning?
Mostly at the RFMOs, they're starting to work together more and more. Panama recently proposed a fins attached regulation at the Atlantic Tuna Commission meeting, which was held just a few weeks ago. And that proposal was co-sponsored by four or five other countries, including the United States, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Brazil. Unfortunately, it wasn't passed for a number of reasons. Probably the main one was that's the body that deals with bluefin tuna, which is really in dire straits right now. Bluefin tuna populations are really crashing, so that was the most urgent topic of the meeting.
How does the situation with bluefin tuna, because it's getting so much media attention, is that possibly, would that possibly help focus attention also on the situation sharks are in, or take away attention from?
It could go either way. Bluefin tuna has been proposed for CITES listing as well for Appendix 1, which would mean a complete ban. Not all bluefin tuna, but Atlantic bluefin tuna, which would be a complete ban on trade in that species. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Part of the argument with sharks is that if we don't start to do a better job at conserving and managing shark species, at some point there's going to be a ban on international trade in sharks. because the populations will have gotten to such a low level that that's the only way we can stop them from becoming extinct.
What about the Convention on Migratory Species? Does that have jurisdiction over sharks?
It does. The Convention on Migratory Species covers all highly migratory species on land and in water, so that includes sharks. That convention has small, what they call MOUs, Memorandum of Understanding, that focus on certain species. And they're developing one right now for sharks.
What will that involve?
Again, they can. Species can be listed on different appendices, sort of like CITES, but they mean different things. And to be honest, I'm not that familiar with that convention. Sharks have been listed on CMS appendices, actually more sharks than have been listed on CITES. And it doesn't come with as great a threat as CITES does. If you violate CITES, trade with the country that has violated the agreement can be suspended. With CMS, there isn't an economic threat like that. It's more of an agreement and an understanding. But they can do things like implement within the countries that are members of the MOU, they can implement a finning ban by requiring that all sharks in those countries are brought to land with their fins attached. Again, there wouldn't be economic sanctions, but it would be more good faith.
And so countries have to sign on to a particular memorandum of understanding, even if they're a signatory of the broader convention, they don't have to agree to a particular proposal contained in a memorandum of understanding. Is that right?
That's right, and interestingly, it can be the other way around too. For example, the United States is not a signatory to the convention, but they are leading the process to create an MOU for sharks. So you can be a signatory to a CMS MOU without being a signatory to the convention itself.
Do all of these conventions work together?
They all do try to work together. Of course, it's complicated, especially when there's a country that's a member of one and not another. But they all have agreements with each other. They all exchange information. And for example, the fishery management organizations try to prevent CITES listings. They try to conserve the species in order to prevent a ban on international trade.
Curious how you got involved in these issues in the first place. I know your route was not a typical route.
I'm not a biologist and I'm not a scientist and I'm not a lawyer. I studied Spanish and sociology in undergraduate school and international business in graduate school. I finished graduate school and didn't know what I wanted to do. The mother of a friend of mine worked for an employment agency and offered to help me find a job. She called me up one day and said, "You like animals, right?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "And you have cats?" And I said, "Yes." And I thought, okay, she's going to ask me if I want another cat. She said, "You're a vegetarian, right?" And I said, "Yes." And I'm thinking, now I really have no idea where she's going with this. And then she said, "How would you like to work for the Humane Society of the United States?" I said, "Seriously? I'd love it." So she set up an interview for me. I started off in 1996 working in the campaigns department of the Humane Society of the United States, so doing domestic work within the US. And as soon as a position opened up in the international branch, I moved there. At first, I was working with shelters abroad, dogs and cats, started doing work with wildlife rehabilitation centers, and then moved on to doing policy work involving wildlife. I've been doing that now for about 8 years.
And do you work mostly on sharks and other marine species?
I do work mostly on marine species, sharks, sea turtles, whales, dolphins, but also land species. I work on elephants and the ivory trade and fur trade and pet trade in wild animals.
Can people do if they want to both learn more or help sharks?
Well, we have, well, for one of the main things they can do is not consume shark fin soup. Of course, not all fins that are used in shark fin soup were caught by finning. Some of the sharks used in shark fin soup, the meat has been used as well, which is better, but you have no way of knowing that. We have a petition art on our website. It's called a No Shark Fin Pledge that you can sign, which will tell you all about thinning, and then you can sign saying that you will not consume shark fin soup. If you go to stopthinning.org, that's part of our website, you can learn all about shark thinning and find the No Shark Fin Soup Pledge. Also, if you live in the United States, of course, you can support the Shark Conservation Act by calling your senator. We also have an action alert for that on our website where you don't even have to call, you just fill out the form on the website and click send. We also have a petition on our website called Don't Buy Wild, which talks about the use of wild animals for things like shark finning, but also for a captive display, for fur, things like for trinkets like ivory and hawksbill sea turtle shell. All of these things are very cruel and unsustainable. So this is a pledge that you can sign that educates you about how to avoid supporting wildlife abuse and pledging that you will not take part in these activities. It usually is something that you would encounter when traveling abroad.
And can you do it unknowingly? No.
In the Cayman Islands, there's a tourist attraction that's for sea turtles. Their idea is to educate people about sea turtles, and they breed sea turtles there, mostly green sea, only green sea turtles, and they release some of them into the wild. The idea is that they're repopulating the oceans with green sea turtles, but they're also, green sea turtles are consumed in the Cayman Islands. It used to be everywhere. Green turtle soup was very popular, but since sea turtles have been endangered, most places they don't consume sea turtles anymore, sea turtle soup. So if you go to this tourist attraction, the Cayman Islands Turtle Farm, a lot of cruise ships will take people there, and you'll see sea turtles in pens. You get to touch them, you get to see them up close. And then you go into the restaurant and there's sea turtle on the menu. But they also give you the option of sponsoring a sea turtle, which, obviously they don't choose an individual sea turtle for you to sponsor, but in theory you could be sponsoring a sea turtle that will end up on the restaurant menu.
Very ironic, because you go to for the conservation and you could end up on the other side.
Yes. Lots of times they won't tell you what something is, or lots of times you'll see something and you'll think, well, this I know this is a shark tooth, but probably, the shark died of natural causes and just washed ashore. Who knows? But that's usually not the case. They'll also usually say that, oh yeah, it's legal to bring this back into the United States when it isn't. It's better really just to avoid this type of activity altogether. I've seen things like purses made out of elephant skin for sale in Thailand. I've seen whole hawksbill sea turtle shells for sale in the Dominican Republic. And that's about the size of, it's bigger than a frisbee. It's about twice as big as a frisbee. And I knew it wasn't legal to bring back to the United States, but I asked and they said, oh, sure. I'm thinking, how would you even hide this in your luggage? It'd be impossible. It would be confiscated. You could be fined. Plus, you'd be supporting an industry where endangered sea turtles are being killed just for their shell.
Well, I really appreciate you your taking time out to talk with me today, and thank you so much.
Great, thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Rebecca Regnery, the Deputy Director for Humane Society International, about the problem of shark finning. Now, let me play you today's creature calls once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. As you may have suspected, the animals that make these sounds are a type of whale. Have you guessed what kind? It's a sperm whale. Sperm whales are the largest toothed whales and can grow to 50 feet long. They have huge blowholes, about 20 inches long, and their brains weigh about 20 pounds, the largest of any animal. Sperm whales might be best known as the title character of the novel Moby Dick. Once again, here's the sound of a sperm whale. For next week's creature call, I'll move to the rainforests of Central and South America, where this elusive mammal lives. Now, here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and also reveal the animal that made it. Next week on The Wildlife, I'll also talk with David Higgins, a criminal intelligence officer specializing in wildlife crime at Interpol. We'll talk about the black market trade in wildlife and what Interpol is doing to stop it. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnimi.com, and at laurelnimi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnimi.com. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.